From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. A big new investigation in The Nation magazine casts a light on the world of big wireless, where it reports the industry's own scientists privately warned them about the risks of cell phone radiation years ago and paid lobbyists to use it to their advantage, just like big tobacco, just like big oil. This hour on Point, big wireless and the cell phone cancer risk. You can join us on air or online. Are you worried about the cancer risk when you use your cell phone? Are you sure it's safe? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk about the teen vaping trend. Joining me first from San Francisco is Mark Hertzgaard, investigative editor at The Nation. He is the co-author of the recent cover story, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, a special investigation. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark, great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So what was your intent with this article, Mark?
I wanted to look at the inside of this industry. This piece is not about the science per se. We do not argue whether cell phones are or are not safe. That's really a judgment for scientists to make. But as journalists, I had done some of the investigating into how big oil lied about climate change. And I noticed a number of years ago that the World Health Organization had said that cell phone radiation was a, quote, possible, unquote, risk. And I just thought, I wonder if there's something more there. And so we started to look, and lo and behold, there was. Our piece is about the campaign that the wireless industry has mounted over the last 25 years, essentially to war game the science, as they put it, and to put their own science out there, and essentially to obscure in the public mind what is the state of the actual science regarding cell phones and cancer.
So take us back to the beginning, really, of all this, back to 1999, to what you call a smoking gun letter written by a scientist named George Carlo. Who is this guy and what did he do?
George Carlo was is still an epidemiologist. He was hired by the cell phone industry basically to deal with a huge public relations problem. And I'll just go back one more decade, if I might. I think the original sin here was that cell phones, and this was the single most astonishing fact I came across in this investigation, cell phones were allowed onto the U.S. consumer market in the 1980s without any government safety testing. And so about a decade later, customers were beginning to get brain cancers and some industry workers, and they began filing lawsuits against the cell phone manufacturers claiming that that was the reason. And then is when George Carlo enters the picture in 1993 because the industry decided that they had to quickly reassure the public and the press and policymakers that their product was safe. So they hired, they said, we're going to do our own science safety investigation here. And they put forward $28 million in 1990 dollars to look into the science. And the guy they hired, they handpicked, is a man named George Carlo, as you mentioned. And he's an epidemiologist. He had been picked, as he himself later told us in our interviews, because they saw me, quote, as an industry guy, unquote. And the reason they did was that he had done studies that said he'd been paid by the chemical industry for studies that said that dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals on Earth, did not pose serious health risks at small doses. He'd said that breast implants were not a problem under payment to the chemical industry. So I think the cell phone industry expected George Carlo to come forward with a certain type of findings. And then after the study was completed in 1999, as you mentioned, that smoking gun letter of October 7, 1999, he sent that to all the CEOs of all the companies, the leading companies in the wireless industry. And he basically said to them, look, there's serious questions here. Our initial research is showing that we do see a risk of cancer and genetic damage, and we need to do more research. But in the meantime, you companies need to do the right thing and tell the public how much we know and how much we don't know so that they can decide for themselves how much of this unknown risk they wish to assume, and especially stop telling people that it's safe for children. That was a very specifically part of that letter, of the smoking gun letter in 1999.
Well, here is George Carlo. Let me play some. This is from, let's see, a YouTube video in 2009, a movie called Whistleblower. This is the wireless industry's handpicked scientist talking about the truth about our cell phones.
On the human epidemiology side, you have studies that show problems or potential problems and studies that are inconclusive. Now, the industry spins the science and they put it out there for public consumption as though these studies are evidence of safety. It is scientific fraud.
Wow, scientific fraud, that's pretty strong. So just to be clear here, Mark, cell phone companies were told by their own scientists, in this case, George Carlo, that there was evidence that cell phones were potentially dangerous?
Potentially dangerous. This was 1999. This is almost 20 years ago, and the dangers were specifically cancer and genetic damage. And Carlo said in 1999, you know, this is not definitive. We need more research. But the point is that it's actually similar to what he just said. The industry looks at the fact that there's not definitive proof of danger and says that means it's safe. That's a very tricky, slippery, logical fallacy. The fact that you don't have 100% proof that something is dangerous does not mean that it's safe. And yet that has been the core response that the industry has given for 20 years when anyone raises these kinds of concerns. And I'm sure that they're raising them now about our article in The Nation magazine.
So are you making comparisons then between the cell phone industry and what tobacco executives did to cover up the dangers of smoking? Is this the same playbook here, Mark?
It's the very same playbook. That's how I got onto this story. I did a piece in Vanity Fair magazine about a dozen years ago that looked at how the fossil fuel companies had deceived people and confused people about the dangers of global warming and spun the science, even though at that point, this is 2006, science had been, you know, overwhelmingly clear that humans were causing climate change, that it was very serious, and that we needed to do something. And as I did the research into the climate denial movement, I came across a guy named Dr. Frederick Seitz. And he was also, it turned out, he was the very same scientist who had been Big Tobacco's big claimant to why cigarette smoking is not necessarily as dangerous as you think. And then by the 1990s, Dr. Seitz had become the most prestigious scientist saying that global warming was a liberal hoax. So that's, I saw that first connection. I think I was the first reporter to make that connection between Big Tobacco and Big Oil. So I knew this history as I and my co-author, Mark Dowie, approached this topic of the wireless industry. And it is really quite striking that it's the same strategies and that the core insight that they use is to create the appearance of scientific uncertainty, to make it look like scientists disagree much more than they actually do.
Let me play some sound here. This is Tom Wheeler. He was then president of the Cellular Telecommunications and Internet Association. Here he is on ABC News in the 1990s.
I mean, I believe that the cellular phone is safe. Our industry has gone out and aggressively asked the question, can we find a problem? And the answer that has come back is that there is nothing that has come up in the research that suggests that there is a linkage between the use of a wireless phone and health effects.
And here's another exchange with him back in the 1990s on ABC News, this exchange with Brian Ross.
Aren't you concerned when you hear those possible health effects?
I have
brain tumors, genetic damage.
I have to look at what the responsible scientists say.
They're alarmed by this.
And they say that there is not a public health effect.
Who says that?
And they say,
who actually says that?
This is what the FDA has said.
The FDA actually said at the time on their website that the research, quote, doesn't lead to the conclusion that cell phones are absolutely safe. Let me bring in now from Colorado Springs, Jerry Phillips, biochemist and director of the Excel Science Center at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. He studied cell phone radiation for a decade and conducted some of the earliest studies on the potential health impacts of cell phones. Great to have you, Jerry. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jane. Thanks.
Thank you. What does your research show?
Well, we did several different kinds of research. We did some research with whole animals in which we used a particular brain tumor model and exposed those rats from the time they were unborn, they were in utero, to radiofrequency radiation. This was one of Motorola's cell phone signals. And what we found was, rather than an increase in brain tumors, central nervous system tumors, we actually saw a decrease, which was just as disconcerting as actually having seen an increase in brain tumors. That was one of our studies. And another one of our studies that's fairly well known, it's been out there for a while, we actually saw changes in damage to cellular DNA. And we saw it in such a way that sometimes we saw an increase, sometimes we saw a decrease. But again, either way, it's a disconcerting result.
And so what do you make of the investigation here in The Nation magazine? What are you hearing here based on your studies and so the history that Mark Hertzgard is laying out here?
Well, Mark's article is a very, very good one. And what I see in the article is a tremendous amount of disturbing information. Disturbing from the perspective of what industry has done to downplay the potential effects on human health and development. Mark is quite correct. There are studies that have been available for years that indicate, and this is what's most disconcerting, that radio frequency radiation from cell phones can interact with living tissue. And when it interacts with living tissue, there are a variety of results that are produced. And many of these results, including some of the latest from studies in Italy, as well as studies from our own national toxicology program, indicate that one of those results is an increase in malignant tumor formation.
We'll talk more about that after the break. We are discussing how Big Wireless convinced us that cell phone radiation is safe. I'm Jane Clayson. Much more after this break. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the tactics the wireless industry has used to spin the science around cell phone radiation. And you can join the conversation. Have you thought at all about the potential health risks of using your cell phone for you and for your kids? Are you waiting for new studies before you panic? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Mark Hertzgard, the investigative editor for The Nation and co-author of the recent cover story, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, a special investigation, and Jerry Phillips, a biochemist and the director of the Excel Science Center at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, who conducted some of the earliest studies on the potential health impacts of cell phones. After a California Department of Public Health released guidelines to reduce exposure to cell phone radiation in December, University of California San Francisco professor Stan Glatz, who uncovered long secret tobacco company research that revealed the dangers of smoking, told CBS in December that he is closely watching the science on cell phones.
Now, unlike cigarettes, cell phones are actually useful for something. The case is by no means closed yet, but there's certainly enough evidence to be concerned, to the point that I don't usually carry a cell phone.
And here is Dr. Joel Moskowitz of UC Berkeley on CBS in December. He sued the California Department of Public Health for refusing to release information about the dangers of cell phone radiation, and he won this spring. Here he is saying that the public should have access to all this research.
Currently, we're not doing a good job in regulating the radiation from these devices. In fact, we're doing an abysmal job. People are being injured and harmed by the delay in having this information accessible to them.
Mark Hertzgard, the California Department of Public Health issued guidelines for cell phone use. Tell us what they said.
They, like a lot of governments around the world, national governments, are taking more of a precautionary approach in line with the idea that we discussed earlier in this broadcast that the lack of definitive proof that something is dangerous does not mean that it's safe. And we need more research. As Stan Glantz just told us, you know, the case is not closed. And we don't say that in our Nation magazine piece either. We do believe that more science is needed. But California, like the government in Britain and France and Israel and numerous other countries, have issued recommendations, in particular to parents, that they want to limit the use of cell phones, especially among their kids. And those of you who are listening who are worried about this, you know, there's a couple of easy things you can do, and I recommend you go to a website run by a group called the Environment Health Trust. They have a lot of useful guidelines, but among them is you must always use earbuds and minimize the use of a cell phone in general. There are these things called landline telephones that I'm old enough to remember. That was all we used to have. And somehow civilization went on just fine. So there's a number of things that you can do about this. But the first thing, I think, is to stop swallowing what the wireless industry has been telling us for 25 years, that everything is fine.
Let's get Theodora in here from Washington, D.C. Hi, Theodora. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, thank you. This is Theodora Scarrato. I'm Executive Director of Environmental Health Trust, and I'm so thankful for this report. I wanted to give an update that just today, because of the tests that were released by the French government that found that when cell phones touch the body, they exceed the regulatory limits like such that our FCC has, that there are cell phones being removed from the market in Europe. And this is of course, a problem with the way our regulations are in the United States. I would like to ask a question and make a quick statement,
Okay. Which
is that when we wrote the FDA asking, telling them that cell phones actually exceed regulatory limits when touching the body, and of course, most people use phones touching their body, resting on their chest, in their pocket, Some women put them in their bra, et cetera. We were told that there was a safety factor by the FDA, and of course, with the National Toxicology Program findings, as well as many other studies that have shown effects at much lower levels, we asked, well, at what level will the FDA act? And I guess what I'd like to ask and start a discussion on is next steps, because the FDA has not done a systematic review of the science, nor has, as is being discussed, any health agency in the United States to understand the human health risk and set proper safety standards. And now we know, of course, that...
Yeah. Theodora, thank you so much. I do appreciate your call and certainly your expertise and experience. Jerry Phillips, I guess the point is, into what Theodora is saying, there's just so much we still don't know. Is that right?
Yeah, and what we don't know is important stuff. One of the things we don't know, and it relates to the point that Theodora was making about regulation and trying to set appropriate regulatory limits, is we still don't know what constitutes dose. We don't know what the important factors are. Cell phones operate at different frequencies. There's different intensities. There's different periods of exposure, times of duration of exposure. And we don't yet know exactly what's important. In terms of regulation, what we do know is that despite what the government believes, regulation shouldn't be based on the amount of energy it takes to heat tissue, because the important biological effects that we're looking at as a response to radio frequency radiation are all produced at levels that don't generate heat in tissue. These are the so-called athermal effects. Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous amount of research that has needed to be done for the past 20, 30 years, and there's very, very little going on in this country. Most of it is overseas.
We reached out to the wireless industry, and we were sent this statement from the Cellular Telecommunications and Internet Association, which I should read here. Following numerous scientific studies conducted over several decades, the FCC, the FDA, the World Health Organization, the American Cancer Society, and numerous other international and U.S. organizations and health experts continue to say that the scientific evidence shows no known health risk to humans due to the RF energy emitted by cell phones. The evidence includes analysis of official federal brain tumor statistics showing that since the introduction of cell phones in the 1980s, the mid-80s, the rate of brain tumors in the United States has decreased. End quote.
Mark Hertzgarn, your response to that.
I very much wish that the trade association had accepted your invitation to come on to the program and actually have a discussion as opposed to just issuing a statement. But I thank them for the statement because it's a very wonderful recent illumination of exactly the kind of misleading approach they've been taking for 25 years now. This is how the disinformation campaign works, folks. Go back and listen to that, and I'm sure it's going to be on the website here at On Point. There's a number of either outright falsehoods or misleading statements there. For example, he talks about how the federal FDA and the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and the WHO, the World Health Organization, have found no known risks. That is misleading to the point of false. The World Health Organization declared in 2011 that it looked at the findings and said that cell phone radiation is, quote, a possible human carcinogen. Mm-hmm. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, although has the statutory authority for regulating the cell phone industry, has no scientists. It doesn't do scientific research. The FDA just asked for a study by the National Institutes of Health, which the industry conveniently ignores. It just came out last week, peer-reviewed last week, I should say, down in North Carolina, and the peer-review scientists looking at the National Toxicology Program study found, quote-unquote, clear evidence that cell phone radiation causes cancer. So what the industry does is they dodge opportunities like this, invitations from a show like this to come on and actually talk about it, and then they issue a misleading statement like that that talks about how supposedly all these government agencies support their position. And I think that you folks can decide who you're going to believe, independent scientists or the companies that are making billions of dollars off your cell phones.
Got a lot of listener response here. Gigi Becker from our Facebook page says, my husband died 4 months ago from glioblastoma. He was a salesman who spent years on his cell phone. His biggest of 9 tumors was right where he held his phone. Katie says, this is fear-mongering of the worst kind. Cell phones do not cause cancer. The bulk of the scientific evidence shows that cell phones do not cause cancer. The electromagnetic radiation that cell phones give off is non-ionizing radiation, which means it does not damage cells or DNA. Here's Tana from Miami Beach, Florida. Hi, Tana. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. My husband is a PhD in radiation biology and a practicing radiation biologist and physician at University of Miami.
Mm-hmm. What does he say about all this, Tana?
Therapy department.
Yeah.
He says to me, because I asked him about this, do not be afraid. There is absolutely no evidence that the kind of radiation that is emitted by cell phones is any hazard to one's health at all. He doesn't oppose his grandchildren, his children, or his wife, or himself from using cell phones.
Tana, thank you. Thanks very much. Let's get Cece in here from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Cece. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I used to run our local education foundation in Ashland, and I personally brought in a lot of wireless technology. And then an electrical engineer friend of mine was reading a book called Zapped and mentioned that there could be biological effects from wireless technology. So I began to investigate, and beyond the cancer studies, which take decades to play out, in which time the industry has a lot of time to promote their products, there is a wealth of additional studies out there. What got me on my feet were the reproduction studies. They have taken male human sperm and exposed it to a laptop with the wireless antennas on, and it changed the DNA. It slowed the motility and caused far fewer sperm to become viable in just 4 hours. So I worked with my schools. We had hoped there would be somebody at the state level who could advise us on this, but the Department of Public Health at that point, probably 4 or 5 years ago, didn't even understand this issue existed. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health has now drafted a series of 4 fact sheets on electromagnetic fields to begin educating the public. Ashland Public Schools has become the first in the nation to even have a sign hanging in our classrooms that says, turn off the Wi-Fi when not in use.
Wow.
Turn off the devices when not in use, and never put a device on your body, because if you drill down into the fine print that comes with your cell phone, let's say if you have an iPhone,
yep,
you can go into Settings, General, About, mm-hmm, Legal, and all the way at the bottom of Legal, you see RF exposure, which is radio frequency radiation.
And it's right there.
Even in their own fine print, it says, don't put this anywhere near your body, or you may exceed the FCC guidelines for public radiation exposure.
CC, thank
Jane,
you.
Can I pop in here?
Yeah, I got to say this, Mark, just a moment. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Go ahead, Mark.
It's interesting what the last caller said. We had that. We had a paragraph in the story that talked about that. We had to cut it for space reasons. But it's very interesting that, again, that the Federal Communications Commission, which the industry on a show like this points out as being the protector of the public health, when they talk among themselves, they talk about, they praise the FCC for, quote, its light regulatory touch, unquote. And part of that is what the caller just referenced. You know, the SAR ratings, S-A-R ratings, which are measurements of the amount of radiation that a cell phone is involved with, you can't find them on the packaging. When you go into a store to buy a phone, you can't find it on the sales packaging. And that's part of what industry pressure did. And the only place you can find it is, as the caller just mentioned, deep, deep, deep in the finest of the fine print, either in your purchase agreement or five steps through the settings program to find out what it is. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the industry self-reports that information. The Federal Communications Commission lets the industry self-report that information rather than doing its own independent testing, which is why Norm Alster, who's with the Harvard Center on Ethics and Journalism, did a report calling the FCC, quote, a captured agency, an agency that has been captured by the very industry it is supposed to regulate. And Thomas Wheeler, who we talked about earlier in the show, who ran the Trade Association in the 1990s, is the perfect illustration. After he left the Trade Association, he went on to become the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission.
We've just got a couple of minutes left here. My goodness, we could go on. There's so much information. Good to know all this for sure. What about 5G technology, Mark Hertzgard? I mean, so much talk about the Internet of Things, big policy push in Washington. You know, some are saying that 5G infrastructure should be nationalized, not owned by private companies, for a variety of reasons, including national security reasons. But my goodness, I'm looking at, you know, 5G infrastructure, pizza-sized transmitters every 250 feet in every city in this country. I mean, talk about that and the increase in radiation reaching the general population as we move forward with this new technology, 5G technology.
Sure. Let's be careful. We're not necessarily moving forward with it. That, too, is buying into the industry's narrative here, that this is somehow a fait accompli, that it has to happen. 5G, fifth generation technology is what that stands for, is critical to the potential advent of the so-called Internet of Things, where your smartphone will be able to communicate with your smart vehicle and your smart home, so that when you're leaving work, you can tell the heater back in your home, get the heat started so I'm going to be warm when I arrive, and you can tell the oven to turn up the stove so that we can cook dinner as soon as we arrive.
Yep.
When Mark Dowie, my co-writer on this article, went to the industry conference, he took a picture, we have it in the Nation magazine, of a baby, a doll of a baby wearing a diaper, and right there at the crotch is a little transmitter, 5G transmitter, to tell mom or dad in the next room, oh, baby's diaper needs changing. That's what 5G is going to be. And the reason, as you mentioned, that in order to do it, they'd have to put these mini transmitters every 250 feet along city streets or suburban neighborhoods, is because the particular type of radiation that 5G uses does not travel as far. So you have to have many, many, probably millions of these pizza box sized little cell phone towers, which will be put on street poles, utility poles, telephone poles, sides of buildings. So when I look out my house in San Francisco, I see a utility pole that's about 20 feet from the bedroom window of my 13-year-old daughter. Hmm. That's where those things are going to be. And that's why the scientists, the independent scientists, have circulated a petition calling for a pause. Let's be precautionary about this before we expose the general population to massively increasing amounts of radiation, in their words.
Jerry Phillips, I'll give you 10 seconds. That's all I've got. Wrap us up. What would you have us remember from this conversation?
There's
there's more to pay attention to than you are going to get by listening to supposed experts. There are definitely biological consequences to being exposed to radio frequency radiation. Do so by getting information. Do so wisely.
Jerry Phillips from the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Thank you so much for your time. And Mark Hertzgard, investigative editor at The Nation, for this terrific piece. Thanks for bringing it to our attention, Mark. Appreciate it. When we come back, the new dangers of teen vaping. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're turning now to the dangerous trend of teen vaping. Devices like e-cigarettes and the new brand Juul with flavors like candy cane and gummy bear and a lot of nicotine. Teenagers, even middle schoolers, are getting hooked. You can join the conversation, listeners. Are you a teen who vapes, a parent who's worried about it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from California to talk about all this is Kate Zernicke. Zernicke, national correspondent for The New York Times. Her recent article is headlined, "I Can't Stop School Struggle with Vaping Explosion." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Great to have you, Kate.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Also joining me from Boston is Dr. Michael Siegel, a physician and professor at the Boston University School of Public Health, where he focuses on tobacco control. Great to have you, Dr. Siegel.
Hi, Jane.
So vaping is everywhere, Kate, to give us a sense of how widespread it is.
I had school principals say to me that what was striking to them about, first of all, nobody smokes cigarettes anymore. But even when people did smoke cigarettes, what they remembered was it was sort of a, you know, it was a certain crew of kids, right? It was a certain bank of lockers, or it was, you know, a certain crowd. But this, they say, is everybody. It's athletes, it's scholars, it's, you know, the kids that you might have seen smoking one day. It's just everywhere. And it's also demographically, you know, it's boys and girls, it's all income levels. It was quite striking to me just how pervasive this was. Mm.
And these students, as I understand it, and from your piece, you talk about sort of a new generation of easily concealed devices to vape with. They have a sleek sort of high-tech design. Tell us about them. Some even look like a little flash drive.
Right. So when I think, you know, when all of us first started seeing vaping devices, maybe you'd be in a restaurant or something before they were regulated there, and you would see this sort of funny, bulky device. It looks more like a TV remote, and it would have this big plume of smoke. What new devices like Juul are, they look, as you say, they look more like a thumb drive, and they don't have, there's nothing, it's not like a cigarette where there's a big, you know, where there's something lit and it's smoking on one end. It really does look like a thumb drive. And so the only puff of vapor that you're going to see is when someone exhales. And so what students are doing in class and in school and in class is exhaling into their sweatshirt, into their backpack. So teachers are finding they just don't know what's happening, and they think they see something, but they're not sure. You had that YouTube video in the beginning of your program, mm-hmm. beginning of this segment. This one principal told me about a video, a principal in California told me about a video he'd seen where teenagers actually filmed themselves or had someone film them standing behind an administrator in the school at vaping, and the joke was that the administrator couldn't even see that this was happening. So I think it's the concealability of the new device that's been so hard for schools, but also for parents, because parents don't, you know, parents are looking for the smell of a cigarette, right? They're looking for tobacco. They're looking for something that looks like a pipe. These are things that they might just think, oh, that's a pen or that's a thumb drive with a term paper on it. Mm.
Dr. Siegel, e-cigarettes have widely been considered to be safer than traditional cigarettes. Is that true or false?
Well, on the whole, e-cigarettes are definitely safer than regular cigarettes. You know, it's hard to compete with something that kills over 400,000 people each year. There's no question they're safer, but they're still not safe at an absolute level. And I think that the real problem is that the Juul represents a qualitatively different device than pretty much all other e-cigarettes. And the difference is that while most e-cigarettes don't deliver nicotine very efficiently, the Juul actually delivers nicotine in the same way that a real cigarette does. So normally, if you smoke a cigarette, there's a very strong peak of nicotine, and that is what creates the nicotine hit or the nicotine buzz, and then it drops off rapidly. And that rapid drop-off is really what creates the addiction, because it leaves you wanting more. If you use a regular e-cigarette, you know, pretty much any standard e-cigarette that's on the market today, you don't get a nicotine hit. You can't feel the buzz, and it doesn't drop off rapidly. The nicotine in the blood drops off very, very gradually. So there's not a lot of addiction potential, but the Juul is different. The Juul delivers the nicotine with a pretty strong hit. So kids who are using these devices will tell you, yeah, I actually feel a buzz.
So kids are getting addicted to Juul, Dr. Siegel.
So yeah, I think that the Juul, unlike most e-cigarettes, the Juul is potentially addictive. And we're seeing a different type of behavior with these devices. With the earlier, typical vaping devices and electronic cigarettes, we were seeing kids who were mostly using these socially, showing off to their friends, just using it occasionally. Mm-hmm. But now we're seeing a different pattern of behavior. With Juul, we're actually seeing more compulsive behavior. We're seeing kids who, they're not just running off to the bathroom to do it because they want to show off or be rebellious, but because they have to. They feel like they really need the nicotine. We see kids who are actually driving and using these devices while they're driving because they can't get off of them. So we're seeing signs of addictive behavior, compulsive behavior with the Juul that we weren't seeing with the regular electronic cigarettes.
In fact, Kate Zernicki, you talk about in your article that Juul is so ubiquitous that kids have turned it into a verb. And what's so interesting to me is the wide assortment of flavors that are being offered that really should belong in like a candy store. I mean, I'm seeing gummy bear and cotton candy and peanut butter cup and cookies and cream, and, you know, the list goes on. Tell us about your reporting on that.
Well, so what Juul will say, the company will say, is that those are actually, I mean, of course, the critics of e-cigarettes will say these flavors are a direct appeal to students. I mean, what adult is going to, or sorry, to young people, to adolescents, what adult who's been smoking cigarettes, what 70-year-old who's been smoking cigarettes is really going to switch to gummy bear, right? What Juul says is, no, in fact, this is part of the moving away from a traditional combustible cigarette. This is part of our intent, that it's really important for an adult who's trying to move away from a combustible cigarette to have a different flavor. But the reality is, mint, maybe, I just think all of these candy flavors, and in some of the other devices we're seeing, you know, some schools talk about this, another device called the Sorin, which looks, one of the models looks like an iPhone. The juice that they put in those, the labels are, they look like a blow pop. So it's a visual appeal to students. And I think, many of the students who I spoke to don't even necessarily, they don't like the taste of a cigarette, but the idea of mango or mint is kind of cool to them.
Here's 17-year-old Christian Toombs of Texas posting a video to YouTube last month to review vaping products that he likes. He also explains why he vapes.
Whenever I think of a vape, I want, like, clouds. Like, that's because, like, the main reason I do, like, have a vape is because, like, I want to do, like, cool tricks with them. Like, have you ever seen, like, those vape montages that, like, are really freaking cool? I've always wanted to, like, do that, like, learn those, like, learn a jellyfish or learn, like, the Bane masks.
Let's get Joseph in here from Kannapolis, North Carolina. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
I am well. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right, so I just want to bring to light that these products are still not regulated at all, that the youth of America or whoever's choosing to consume these products are taking huge risks. There's nothing out there, no evidence or documentation to say that there's no health risk to these. Who's to say that the chemicals that they're putting in to give these flavors aren't causing issues?
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, where are the parents at? Where are the parents in all this? This is not something that should be brought to our youth and looked as something they should be wanting to do.
Joseph, thank you. Let me get Michael in here from New Orleans. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
This seems to me to be a much ado about nothing because it's an education issue. We've been telling youth of America that drugs are bad, alcohol consumption is bad, nicotine consumption is bad. Why is this any different?
Michael, thank you. Dr. Siegel, why is this any different? Much ado about nothing, Michael says.
Well, I think that the problem here with the Juul really is the risk of addiction. And, you know, I mean, having kids blowing smoke rings and that type of thing may all be innocent. And kids who are using it with that kind of a pattern, where it's just for, you know, showing off and as a social thing, that's probably not a very dangerous or destructive behavior. The problem is that there are a lot of kids who are using the Juul and they intend initially to use it in a way that's just a kind of a social phenomenon, but they end up getting hooked, and literally they lose control, and they don't have control over the behavior, and they become addicted. And, you know, the problem with addiction is that in and of itself, it may not be you know, harmful. It depends what substance you're using. Mm-hmm. The problem with it, though, is that there is evidence that nicotine does, when you're addicted to it, it does cause changes in the brain, and it can make you more susceptible to addiction in general. And so we worry that somebody who develops an addiction to nicotine later in life might be more subject to a danger, to addiction to a more dangerous substance.
I see. Kate Zernike, federal law prohibits the sale of e-cigarettes to anyone under 18, but the vaping industry seems to have a campaign that appeals specifically to the youth. I mean, I'm thinking about our caller's reference to regulation. I mean, the campaigns are not to adults.
That's true. So there was one ad. We didn't mention the story because it ran in 2015, but the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids has it on their website. It's for candy pens, and it's a picture of a laptop, an academic planner, and a little Post-it note and with a to-do list, and the to-do list says, you know, something, homework, band practice, vape time. So the idea is that this is something that fits into your school day. So it's definitely a straight appeal. I want to emphasize one thing that Michael said, which is true. What you heard over and over from kids and from school administrators was that these devices started showing up at parties, and then they ended up on campus. That's something that's different here. And so what the school administrators are left to believe is that the students, that it did start out as a social thing, and now the students are thinking, oh, I can bring it here, partly because it's kind of a gimmick to bring it in school, but then, of course, it does become something that they need. Mm-hmm. On the question of regulation, the other concern is that the vaping industry got the FDA to postpone by 5 years a rule that would have had them regulating any device that was introduced on the market after February 15th of 2007, which includes the Juuls. So we now have 5 more years of delay before the FDA is going to start regulating these products and going to be required to mm-hmm. approve them. So it's not just about the age. There are other limitations. There are other restrictions that could have been placed on these, or other just simple, you know, regulatory, what right. we think, are these right. safe? And right. we haven't done that.
Back to the phones. John in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, John. Glad you're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I guess I can say I was always one of those kids that was in high school sneaking out the back door, sticking a pen in the door jamb and going out to smoke a cigarette.
Okay.
And it turned out, you know, 10 years later, I quit smoking by vaping. And, you know, it's kind of become a hobby for me over the last couple of years. I've gone down in my nicotine level, but I've gotten more into we have a vaping community here in Dubuque, believe mm-hmm. it or not, mm-hmm. The coil building and things like that.
So it helped you quit cigarettes. John, thank you. Let me get you. I'm running out of time. Dr. Siegel, is there actually a benefit to vaping from people who are trying to cut the cigarettes?
Well, there is. For adult smokers, the advantage of vaping is that it addresses not only the pharmacological addiction to nicotine, but also the physical aspects of addiction. Smoking is more than just addiction to nicotine. There are also behavioral aspects. There's holding the cigarette, the feeling of the oral sensation, the feeling of the throat hit, the psychological associations of smoking and other behaviors. And when you put a nicotine patch on, it gives you nicotine, but it doesn't replace all the other aspects of smoking. So the reason why so many smokers are finding vaping is an effective way of helping them quit is that it does replace these other aspects of the addiction. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, because while vaping products are really a benefit to adult smokers, there are risks for youth. And the Juul is a particular double-edged sword, because what makes the Juul so effective for adults, which is the fact that it does deliver nicotine in the way that cigarettes do, which means that many more adult smokers are finding the Juul satisfying and
right.
are able to quit smoking using it. But that very same principle that makes it effective with adults makes it much more problematic for youth.
Let me play this. Mike Stock, he's the dean of students at Naperville High School in Chicago, told the Chicago Tribune in February that vaping is a growing problem among his students.
We've just seen a great increase of the number of students that have been found to be using or possession of these devices. From the last 3 years combined, we've far exceeded those numbers this year, and we're still only in February. More students are exposed to it, more students are seeing it, being around it, and using it than we think, is what I truly believe.
Kate Zernike, I'm reading in your piece about schools installing vaping detectors in the bathrooms. Tell me what schools are doing to combat this, and many moving from punishment to intervention at this point.
Yeah, so we've had schools doing the things that they probably might have done with cigarettes, such as closing bathroom stalls or closing bathrooms entirely, putting monitors at bathrooms. Some schools have looked into installing vaping monitors like a smoke detector. But I think a lot of schools are now recognizing that this is an addiction. And I think, you know, what they're trying to do is they feel like we were very effective at educating students against the dangers of traditional cigarettes. We weren't great about talking to students about nicotine addiction. So they're trying to do more education around vaping for students, but also for parents, because parents, as I said earlier, don't necessarily know what to look for. But I think they're also, you know, for some students, they're trying to get them. I mean, what was amazing to me was this one school offering students, you know, a patch or, some other device that we would have seen to withdraw from smoking.
Dr. Michael Siegel, you get the last word. What do you want us to know about vaping today?
Well, I think it's important that parents understand that there really is a difference between vaping and juuling. And, you know, 6 months ago, I would say that the vaping problem among youth was not very, you know, not a terrible problem. Kids were doing this in an innocent kind of social way.
Right.
I think the Juul has changed the landscape, and the Juul really is an addiction risk. And kids who are using it are becoming addicted. The pattern of use has changed. And so I think that parents really need to be aware of this Juul device. And we need to find a way to try to kind of, I think, educate kids.
What you were trying to do today. And Dr. Siegel, I so appreciate your time there from Boston University. Kate Zernike from the New York Times. Terrific piece. Turned us on to this. Listeners, thanks so much to you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.